I love it.
She's only three.
Some of the bills that we're going to introduce, and also some of the issues for our lovely folks out there. So anyway, we'd like to welcome you all, and we are going to, we'll talk about it, and we are going to miss a few of our members starting January 1, like Representative Matthews and Representative Thompson. We'll have to walk across the hall to see Representative Thatcher and Representative Freeman. And trust me, you guys are going to be missing the legislatures. Or at least on our side.
Freeman's going to be down there in the commission.
I know, he's going to be causing trouble in Douglas County. I expect to see him here.
I mean, on the south side.
It kind of fits his character.
That's right. Okay, so first of all, is it Sean?
I hope so.
Okay, so the first group we're going to hear from is, we haven't met him yet, is the introduction of the new director of Business Oregon, Sean Robbins. Thank you. Welcome. Hey, welcome.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Vice Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for the invitation to be here this morning. This is our first time meeting, indeed. So by way of introduction, I'll keep it short, just to say that my first day on the job was June 1st of this past year, so I've been just under 6 months now as a director of the agency.
And you need to introduce yourself for the record, please.
For the record, Sean Robbins, Director of Business Oregon.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Doherty. Thank you. So, as I was saying, I was appointed by the governor and approved by the Senate on June 1st of this past year, and one of the first priorities of my time as director was to get on the ground, if you will, throughout all of Oregon, along with members of my executive team in partnership with the governor's regional solution centers and the Oregon business plan. And one of the things we did is we organized 12 town halls across the state. The best way, in my opinion, to get an understanding of what's happening in the real-time economy is to talk to folks directly on the ground, both on the community infrastructure and development side, as well as business and economic development stakeholders. So we organized 12 town halls across the state over a 7-week period in the months of June and July, brought over 1,000 folks together. And one of the things, most important things you'll hear throughout almost all of my presentations and my approach going forward with our executive team and what we heard from folks on the ground is that the single most important thing we can do as an agency for economic development is to support the growth of our existing companies and help them accelerate their job growth going forward. And that message was heard loud and clear by myself and our executive team and most of the rest of the stakeholders who were there. And it's supported by data. And there's an important piece of data that I'd like to share with you and hope that you remember, which is that 70%, roughly 70% or more of the job growth in the average or typical American community is from companies that are already in that community. So while new recruitments often get top of the fold coverage and get most of the attention, the reality is statistically and from the data perspective, existing companies are the primary source of new job creation in the typical American community. So what we're doing at the agency over the first 6 months is to make sure that the priorities, the investments, the tools that we have, our philosophy as an agency is solely aligned around growing our own, which is the slide behind me. Simple phrase, but says a lot, which is that those companies who are here, who have roots in the state of Oregon, are our first priority, and asking them, how do we grow your jobs from 100 employees today to 150? Because the return on investment for taxpayers is far better in growing those next 50 than it is for us to go out and try to convince companies from North Carolina, Alabama, Mississippi, Tennessee to uproot and move to Oregon. So we want to first start with those companies. What that means specifically inside Grow Our Own is a focus on 5 key areas: innovation and entrepreneurship, business retention and expansion, global trade, access to capital, and of course, infrastructure finance, which for those who may or may not know this information, Inside Business Oregon is the infrastructure finance authority, roughly $400 to $450 million per biennium in programs like the Special Public Works Fund for infrastructure finance, which was, quite frankly, one of the most tangible and relevant products of the work that we do in most rural communities throughout the state. So as I said, we toured the state. We brought together over 1,000 stakeholders. We also conducted internally a series of professional reviews on a couple core areas of our agency's historic work on business development and business finance. Again, looking to determine what programs are used, what's the efficacy of those programs, and again, making sure that they're focused on first growing and retaining the companies that we already have in Oregon as our primary foundation for economic development. And here's some of the things we found. First, there is a fair amount that we're doing very well. In particular, one of the things I took away from folks that we visited throughout the state was that they view our agency as a very disciplined fiduciary of the resources that we've been given, and that we're in fact investing those resources in their communities in ways that are smart, intelligent, and have a great deal of transparency to them. Second strength, which I think is really powerful, and which you'll hear especially on growing our own going forward, is that our infrastructure as an agency is actually set up to match the fact that Oregon is not a single state economy, but is a population of regional economies. So a significant amount of our agency staff is distributed throughout the state on the ground, 11 regions throughout the state. One of the things we've done in the last 6 months is to make sure that the boundaries of our business development officers on the ground actually match the Regional Solutions Center boundaries of the governor's office to make sure that we don't have competing boundaries and competing interests for what we're all trying to do on the ground together. The third is really the sort of the results, if you will, in the last biennium. A couple quick numbers for you. 2,000 jobs created, 6,700 jobs retained, $28 million in tax income tax generated, and over $87 million in export sales alone generated through our global trade program. So there's a significant bulk of work that the agency has already done around growing our own. But unfortunately, one of the things I found over and over again is that most people around the state had no idea who our agency was, had no idea what we did, and quite frankly, didn't have a good sense of what our economic development strategy was for the state of Oregon going forward, something that is unacceptable in my mind and something we're going to change going forward. That leads me into the challenges piece. Again, growing our own is a focus on making sure that our stakeholders, your constituents, have a clear understanding that focusing on building the companies we've already got is our first priority. But a second challenge is that many people on the ground think that the agency and the state's economic development efforts are focused on supporting business, big business versus small business. And while that may sometimes get the headlines, the reality is that, I've got one example here, just one of the many programs we have, 53%, over half of the total projects out of the Strategic Reserve Fund are funding small businesses that under 100 employees. And of course, your definition of small can change these numbers quite a bit. Small Business Association says it's anything under 500 employees, which is a medium-sized businesses. If you add up the medium and small business support, the majority of the funds, majority of the projects are going to small and medium-sized business in our agency. The other perception, of course, you hear all across Oregon is that the state's economic development efforts are often focused on the urban areas, mostly Portland-centric versus rural-facing, when in fact 76% of the Strategic Reserve Fund projects by the number of projects are being given outside the Portland metro area, and 59, or about 60% of the funds are being invested in Strategic Reserve Fund outside the Portland area in rural communities. And the Special Public Works Fund, of no surprise, upwards of 90% and 96% of the funds within SPWF programs are going to rural communities as opposed to urban areas. But these challenges are things we face in helping people understand, going back to that primary challenge, which is who we are, what we do, and what our plan is for the economy going forward. So with that, the actions going forward align entirely around growing our own. Everything in innovation, entrepreneurship, business development, access to capital, infrastructure finance, all of those are being looked through the lens of, are those programs geared towards retaining the companies we've got first, helping them grow second, start up new companies, and then building a targeted recruitment strategy last that fills in the supply chain gaps of those key industries. A couple highlights from the governor's budget. One of the most important accelerated efforts we're undertaking going forward as an agency is a renewed focus on rural economic development. And what do I mean by rural economic development? And these are things we heard from folks on the ground as we toured the state. First, a rural infrastructure fund, an infrastructure opportunity fund for near-term job creation prospects where there are not funds available to help accelerate and finish the last mile of a project but are critical to making sure those jobs appear in rural communities. The governor's recommended budget is proposing a rural infrastructure opportunity fund, something we think is going to be extremely powerful to helping move those near-term job creation opportunities forward, not backfilling existing community infrastructure needs, but focusing solely on being the bridge, if you will, to the last mile of a rural job creation project. Second, a rural and natural resource commercialization fund so that our agency is involved in helping move things like small diameter juniper, cross-laminated timber, advanced agriculture technology, unmanned aerial systems. All of these are innovations within the natural resource space, but exist almost entirely in rural Oregon. Again, we've proposed a fund along with the governor's recommended budget to give us space almost for what is akin to an Oregon Innovation Council, but for natural resource innovation and technology going forward. We also, back on the traditional infrastructure piece, special public works fund levy reconstruction to the tune of $28 million in the special public works fund, recapitalized special public works fund, as well as recapitalizing the brownfields fund. Both of these funds critical to on-the-ground industrial land supply, as well as the infrastructure that services that industrial land, today are at zero. So we're asking to recapitalize these funds, again, as part of a rural infrastructure opportunity strategy going forward. On the innovation side, we're looking to increase total funding to Oregon Inc. Over the last four biennium, the return on investment is palpable. We've invested $77 million into Oregon Inc. over the last four biennium. It's produced $130 million of private follow-on funding, $400 million of federal grant follow-on funding, created 90 companies, and today over 300 companies in the state are using the services of the Signature Research Center. So we're expanding the success of that program from $19 million to $29 million in the governor's recommended budget. Again, all focused on the theme of trying to grow the companies, to grow the entrepreneurs that are already in this state. Much of what the agency has done over long periods of time, but being much more explicit and focused on it because we know we do not have endless resources, time, or energy, but we need to invest them in ways that create the most palpable and tangible return on investment possible. And the data speaks very clearly on this, that if we do focus on the companies we've already got, we're going to accelerate job creation over the short and medium term. We don't do any of this work, obviously, in a vacuum. We have partners all around the state. We're a small agency by relative standards of 135 full-time employees working on behalf of Oregon's economy. We have great regional partners, the regional solution centers, multiple agencies that do this work. Economic development isn't just a standalone, isolated feature that we can control, manipulate at will, but it's in fact an aggregation of many of the activities that people do all around the state. In closing, what I'd just like to say is I'm looking forward to the opportunity. This is my first time going through a legislative session as a director of a state agency. I hope you'll be tough on us and at the same time a little easy on us at times. We have a lot to do over the next 6 months, include many of which is in this governor's recommended budget. But also I want to emphasize over and over again that our strategy, and I hope a strategy that you can take home to your constituents, is that growing our own, focusing on the companies we already have, is the key to continuing the rate of job growth in the state, but also accelerating, making sure that the prosperity that the state is achieving in some parts of the state actually reach other parts of the state going forward as well. With that, Madam Chair, I'll take any questions you might have.
Thank you. Do you have any questions, comments? Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Chair Doherty, and welcome, and thank you for joining the great enterprise of Business Oregon. I'm going to tell you a little story, and I'm sort of preaching to the choir here because there's many small business owners sitting up here, but maybe there'll be people out there that'll hear this, and maybe you can take it back to your organization and have it part of your theme as you move forward. So in my community, you talk about small business being 100. I'm going to talk to you about a small business that has 5 employees. A young couple about 15 years ago moved to Oregon and opened a little portable taco wagon. They moved around Roseburg trying to find a good location that worked for them. About 7 years ago, they landed and have a good location, have been there for 7 years. Raising a beautiful little family, they got 3 kids. The oldest daughter started University of Oregon this year. So about a week ago, they get a letter from the city of Roseburg. And this letter tells them that they're out of compliance and they need a temporary use permit for the land use where they're at, which doesn't sound real scary to most of us because we've been through the land use process. To them, it sounded like the end of their business. So they contacted me, and I had them contact a land use planning company that did this work, and they were quoted a $1,500 bill to fill out the paperwork and turn this in for them. They were also informed if any of the businesses around or property owners around had any sort of problem with them being there, it would get referred to the Planning Commission and possibly to the City Council, where they could be told they couldn't be where they're at. So this gentleman and his wife approached me with the idea just weeks before Christmas that instead of having their daughter attend her second term at University of Oregon, they were going to have her take a term off so they could pay for this land use planning issue. It is no issue at all. Now, we're going to solve this problem. I have the ability to help them financially, and I will personally. But as we talk about growing business in Oregon and finding ways for business in Oregon to be successful, we better think about the heavy hand of government crushing business. So hopefully you can take that story back. I can elaborate on it if you had more time, and I'm not going to take the committee's time, but that is occurring all over this state every single day. And that should be part of what you all focus on at Business Oregon, helping the legislature and government find a solution to not have that issue.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions? We've got about 2 minutes. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the things you mentioned, and it's something we've worked on here a fair amount, is the brownfield funds and everything. I'm almost wondering, have you looked at some hold harmless for businesses or people or enterprises that go in and buy some of these brownfields? Because it's become a very large issue. We've dealt with it with insurance companies. We've actually had a bill dealing with two constituents of mine. One was Schnitzer Steel, and the other was Oregon Mutual Insurance over some of the cleanup and things like that that are going on. I would like you to actually look into and take a look at ways where maybe the state should be stepping in and taking care of some of these issues, because some of these brownfields happened long, long ago, and right now the business, I can't go out and get insurance to protect me from that sort of thing because they're starting to write it out of the policies because of the actions we've taken here locally. So that would be something I would actually encourage you to look at, because it is a serious issue for some of our industrial lands, and I can understand why people would be scared to buy commercial property that's been near a filling station or anything like that. So that'd be something else to look at.
And I'll say just very briefly, Madam Chair, Business Oregon is not a regulatory agency, but one of the things we heard time and time again on the road, and something I took straight to my heart, was the fact that a lot of Oregon businesses, and this goes to Representative Freeman's story as well, sometimes don't feel as though they always have the biggest champion inside state government for the growth of their businesses. And so while we're not a regulatory agency, we do and we have taken on as part of our mission to make sure that we retell those stories and work collaboratively with our regulatory partners at other agencies to make sure that we educate at least ourselves about the implications of certain policy choices and its impact on the economy and certain businesses that we're trying to grow. So it's certainly something, even though we're not directly involved in holding harmless on brownfields and we're providing the funds for the cleanup, it's certainly something we would have an active interest in trying to help learn and educate others about.
If I may follow up.
Quick follow-up, please.
any information that you get that businesses are running to, like the stories that Representative Freeman just gave you, if you can feed those to us so we can take care of them, because we're still in the early stages where we can get stuff done. So anything you've heard or that your staff has heard, we would love to have that information.
Will do. Okay, thank you.
Any other questions, comments? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank
and
you,
welcome.
Chair.
Okay, next we have earned paid sick leave, Representative Jessica Vega Peterson and Senator Elizabeth Steiner Haywood. Welcome. And make sure we know who you are, but you need to identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Elizabeth Steiner Haywood, State Senator for District 17, Northwest Portland and Beaverton, and also a family physician in my spare time. Madam Chair, members of the committee, we come today to talk to you about the very important question about earned sick leave. This is an opportunity to report back to the committee on this issue, as you will remember, came before the 2013 session. There was substantial conversation, very useful, productive, and in the intervening time since then, Representative Vega Peterson and I convened a work group, which consisted of a wide range of people and made a very inclusive. Representative Vega Peterson will describe that in a little bit more detail, but we wanted to be sure that we had proponents and opponents at the table at all times and kept this very open. Currently, 47% of private sector workers outside of Portland and Eugene do not have access to a single paid sick day. And that includes 71% of low-wage workers who are the most likely to need that pay when they miss a day of work and are least likely to have access to this paid sick time. We believe passing a strong statewide paid sick time standard is important for the health and welfare of all Oregonians. As a public health measure, we believe nobody should have to choose between their job and their health or the health of a family member. And I will say, as a family physician, there's nothing that annoys me more than seeing somebody come to work hacking and coughing and with a fever, and we know they're not actually doing any of their work, and all they're doing is getting everybody else sick. And we're certainly seeing it these days with issues around quarantine for Ebola and other issues. So protecting workers under these circumstances is really important. This policy will be very beneficial to all Oregonians. It will benefit the health by preventing the spread of illness and disease. It'll prevent women and working families from having to make a choice between missing a single day of work or putting food on their table, which is really the choice that people often make. We know that Oregonians need this paid sick time. Our goal in convening this work group was to drill down into the details and the mechanics of a paid sick time concept to see if there are areas where we could make improvements based on the feedback from stakeholders. And although we realized, of course, that the group might not be able to reach complete consensus.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair Doherty and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jessica Vega Peterson. I'm the state representative from House District 47, which is in East Portland. I am not a family medical doctor, but I do have a cold, so I'm also qualified to
testify. The senator.
Excellent.
The hand sanitizer is over here.
So as the senator said, this work group that we were co-chairs of was a result of the legislation that was presented in 2013. What we did over the course of 7 work group committee meetings was to review very thoroughly that legislation. Our goal in that process was to make sure that we had a very open and inclusive process. And I think it's fair to say that we were able to achieve that. All voices were heard and all interested parties were present during those work group meetings. We knew that the goal of the goal was never to reach consensus. We knew that was probably out of reach, but we were able to make substantial improvements to the 2013 legislation, which you'll see in the 2015 draft, based on the concerns that we heard and the revisions that were proposed. So the last time we reported to this committee, we had just finished doing a line-by-line review of that 2013 legislation. We did identify several areas where improvements could be made on that draft, and we took that back and we incorporated those into a 2015 draft. One of the things that we did do towards the end of our work group sessions was to have all of the participants go through a exercise where they would identify their most important priorities or hot button issues around paid sick time. And those were issues like the appropriate waiting period, preemption, employer threshold size, and sick time accrual. So using all of that feedback, using those issues that had been identified, we drafted LC 1228 and 1229, which are identical House and Senate versions of the 2015 concept.
And they are on OLIS.
And they're on OLIS.
The meeting materials for today.
Last Friday, just last Friday, we reconvened the work group to review that draft. It was just back from LC, so it was the first time a lot of folks had the chance to review it. Our goal, again, when working through that draft was to make sure that all concerned parties at the table had their concerns heard. And we really want to thank the participants of that work group for looking through this and working through it with us. Because of the careful attention to detail of many people there, we've already identified a couple necessary amendments that we're going to make, like making sure that we have the best and correct definition of employer so that we don't inadvertently capture independent contractors. We also know that there's a provision that appears twice in the LC draft that we're going to have to fix that. So this is all a critical piece of the legislation draft process. We also have the benefit now of additional paid sick time policies enacted in the state, both Portland and Eugene, as well as different nationwide policies. And so we're able to use the experiences there to draft our legislation. And we will continue to listen as we go forward with this 2015 legislation in listening to the concerns, the suggestions from both advocates and employers on shaping the policy for Oregonians.
We'd like next to give you a quick update on the new legislation ordinances that have been passed since we last met. And I want to clarify one thing Representative Vega Peterson just had. We have plenty of employers, small and large, who are supportive. So it's not just that all employers are opposed and other groups are in favor. There are divisions that cross traditional lines on this issue, and it's important to note that. Because and different people have opinions about different issues within the bill. So it's going to be that's one of the reasons it was very important for us to have this work group be so broad. As Representative Vega Peterson mentioned, Oregon's two largest cities, Portland and Eugene, have now passed sick time ordinances. Eugene's ordinance passed on in late July of this year, and it covers all private sector workers in that city. Its law will go into effect on July 1st of 2015, and they're currently in the rulemaking process. We expect that those rules will be finalized prior to the convening of the 2015 legislative session in late January. Eugene's law is a little different from Portland's in that it requires all employers, regardless of size or the number of employees, to provide paid sick time. Otherwise, the two laws are very similar. Employees accrue 1 hour of sick time for every 30 hours worked for a maximum of 40 hours per year, and employers can always allow more than the law requires, and many businesses already do. One of the major things that you'll notice in the 2015 legislation is that, like Eugene's law, this concept will cover all employees and all employer sizes. Paid sick days are about public health and equity, and we believe that nobody gets sick based on the number of employees in a business or a company. And the spread of infection, obviously, is probably even a greater risk in a small business where everybody's working in closer proximity. So we want to make sure that we equalize this. We understand that this is a topic that will have to be discussed as things go through, but that is a change that you'll notice in the 2015 version of the bill. In addition to Eugene and Portland, their election day in 2014 was a clean sweep, as it were, for paid sick days across the country. Voters in Massachusetts, statewide, and then three cities, Oakland, California, and two New Jersey cities, passed sick time laws. So now Connecticut, California, and Massachusetts all have statewide policies, and 15 cities, San Francisco, Seattle, New York, Washington, D.C., Portland, Eugene, Oakland, Jersey City, Newark, and six more cities in New Jersey have these ordinances or laws. So it is clearly on an upward trajectory, and it's important that Oregon not fall behind as a place where people want to come and work and live and can stay healthy while they do so. This is a popular policy with voters. voters, because although it's a relatively small incremental change, it can make all the difference in the life of one worker or one family when their family is affected by illness. So we are well positioned now to become the fourth state to pass such a policy statewide.
So I don't want to go through line by line on the draft with you, but I did want to point out some of the major changes and updates that were made to this 2015 LC draft compared to what we were working with in 2013. So some of the major changes, the first is in Section 1. So in the workgroup last fall, Bowley actually flagged that the provision of the sick time law would be more appropriately placed in the wage and hour law section of statute instead of the civil rights law, although retaliation provisions for this would still be enforced under the civil rights law. So you'll find that in Section 1 of the new LC. In Section 2, as Senator had mentioned, there's no employer threshold size. So like Eugene's law, the 2015 bill covers all employees and all employer sizes. In Section 2, Sub 3, there's an expanded definition of family member. And this change was made because it more appropriately captures family relationships in a post-marriage equality world.
Can I just mention the other part of that?
Mm-hmm.
The one other part that's really important to bear in mind is this does not just relate to marriage equality. In my practice, we see often elderly people who have no closer by blood family member than, say, a niece or nephew who's their primary caregiver. And under traditional definitions of family, that niece or nephew would not be able to take earned sick time or family medical leave to care for that aunt or uncle. And it's really important that we maintain these family relationships and recognize those so that we protect our aging population as well.
Thanks for mentioning that. The next section where there's a major change is in Section 4, Sub 4, which is it added an increments of use section. So this will allow sick time to be taken in no more than 1 hour increments or whatever the smallest increment of time an employer already uses in their payroll system. And this is the standard that makes that brings this policy consistent with FEMLA, the Family Medical Leave Act. So that is just a standardization there. In Section 5, Sub 1B, we added language about being able to front load the 56 hours of paid sick time, and this was a change that was made at the employer request to make record keeping simpler for them. If they just want to front load paid sick time at the beginning of their year, they would be able to do that. In Section 7, we revised this entire section. Again, this was at the request of employers, some employers in our work group. They preferred to have a an employee's requirement to notify an employer of intention to use paid sick time modeled on what was in the Seattle ordinance. So in the Seattle language, there was a 10-day advance notice, and that is what we have put forward in this 2015 draft, which is a change from the 7 days that was in the 2013 bill. In Section 11, Sub 3, we also, we clarified some of the policy here. This section has to do with retaliation. And that was actually making sure that any absence control policies, anybody who uses paid sick time, it wouldn't be couldn't be used against them in a review process. Section 12 was an addition. It's a severability clause. This is just a standard saying that if one part of the legislation struck down, the whole thing is not struck down. And those are the major changes.
Right. And there are several key provisions that are identical. Again, we're keeping these in this way at the request of both employers and some of the trades. In Section 12, we allow shift trading, which is very important, in particular to the restaurant and lodging industry, and employees want this as well. And in Section 3, Sub 8, workers represented by a building or construction trade union continue to be exempt because those are covered under their collective bargaining units, their structure for this. We really appreciated the participation of business representatives. We had NFIB, we have AOI, we have OBA, we have ORLA, we have pretty much every major group we could think of. We tried very, very hard to be inclusive, and the group grew as it went along to make sure we had as many voices at the table as possible. And we appreciate their constructive participation. Even and I think that if you ask any of them, they'll say that even though they don't like particularly every provision of the proposal that's being put forth, they do believe that the work group process was fair and inclusive, and that was very important to the representative and myself.
Thank you. So, and we just want to thank you so much for the opportunity to present the updates to you this morning. We're excited to bring forward this concept for 2015. It's an important policy for workers and families in Oregon, and we're looking forward to working as this develops in the next session. So we're happy to answer any questions that you have at this time.
Okay, do you have any quick questions? Okay, just great presentation. Oh, excuse me, Representative Freeman.
Very briefly. Thank you for the presentation, and I'm really interested, and I'll do it offline, to learn more about this public health concern that you brought up. And sort of in that vein, I'm curious, was there any discussion, since it is sort of being touted as a public health, a good for everybody idea, of having maybe a tax credit pay for it, so everybody pays for it?
We did not talk
about that. We did not talk about that, but we're certainly open to ongoing suggestions for improvement, Representative. We'd be more than happy to talk with you about that.
Thank you.
Any other? Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I won't be here to ask the questions or to make the statements, and some of you are probably happy about that, so you have a much better chance in this committee. I'll continue to express my concern about moving forward, and I can appreciate the job of the work group, but to me, especially relieving now every business to include, you know, two people versus a six plus, but it's going to have to get paid for in some fashion. Everybody wants to increase now, not everybody. There's a group that wants to increase minimum wage. There's a group that wants to increase benefit packages. Now we want to do paid sick leave. It's got to get paid for some way. So as a business owner, I'm just going to say from this seat, and it won't be the last statement I'll make, but I want to be very cautious moving forward and to keep those things in mind, because people are being impacted, and we are not out of this recession. We see what's going on is promising, but that doesn't mean that, hey, it's okay to go full tilt. But I can tell you, and I know, I've already told my wife, next session, this is coming. And you have the numbers, it'll happen. And it's going to be very contentious, and it's going to be very disappointing. But it is what it is. I get where it's at, but it's got to be one of those issues that it's going to be paid for in some capacity, whether people don't get increases, whether they're not hired at the same starting rate, whether prices go up for the care you're providing, whatever it is, it's going to get paid for in some way. This doesn't just happen by the governor signing a bill.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair, if I may.
Quickly, please.
Thank you. Representative Matthews, I appreciate that concern. I think we all do. I think we have to bear in mind other costs that will be avoided. For example, if people lose pay because they don't have earned sick time and they have to care for themselves or a sick child, that's income that they can't spend in our economy. If they lose enough pay, then they may lose their housing, at which point we're dealing with housing benefits or the costs associated with homelessness. There are ramifications on both sides. We completely appreciate those that you've pointed out. I think it's just important to balance those on the other economic ramifications that may be avoided if we were to implement this policy.
Okay. And Madam Chair, if just
quickly,
the concern I had in 13 will remain as it goes forward in 15. I'll just be in a different seat. And that is just on the employer's part of it. At what point do they get to say, were you truly sick? And what's the ramification if they ask that question? Because as it was written in 13, they weren't really allowed to ask that question with immediate response. So I appreciate that the work's being done.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Representative Matthews, that is in the proposal for the 15 session. It's pretty clear documentation about that, and it's consistent with, it allows them to be consistent with other employee policies that they have about documenting stuff. So we do have that well written into this bill, sir.
Okay. And Chair Doherty, just very quickly, Representative Matthews, I appreciate your concern. I would just say that based on the experience in San Francisco, that hasn't shown to be a problem. 25% of the people who had paid sick benefits expanded to them actually didn't use any of the paid sick days, and the median days off taken were 3 days over that. So that's just some of the data that we're gaining from some of the experiences in other cities, and we're going to be incorporating that in the work that we do. So thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions, comments? Okay,
thank you very much, Madam Chair, for the presentation.
Okay, next on the agenda, Treasurer Wheeler, Oregon Retirement Savings Task Force.
Okay.
Okay, thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ted Wheeler. I'm the Treasurer for the State of Oregon.
I'm Kristen Johnson, Senior Policy Advisor in the State Treasury.
So we were asked to present to you a report that was completed approximately 2 months ago now, but we thought it would be useful for you to hear this report as your new legislative session begins. And first of all, I'd be remiss if I just didn't say welcome back. It's good to see you all again. And we have a lot of work to do this session, and this issue of retirement security is certainly a very important one to a lot of people in this building. Just by way of setting the context, here in the state of Oregon, we have what could be characterized as a crisis when it comes to the adequacy of retirement savings of our citizens. Just to give you a couple of stark facts, less than half of our citizens in this state have only saved something less than $25,000 for their retirement, half of our employees, of our workers. More than a quarter of the people who work here in the state of Oregon have actually saved less than $1,000 for their retirement. There are a number of rules out there about what an adequate level of retirement savings is. Most of them say something to the effect of 70 to 80% of your final year of salary. Whatever it is, we know that it's not $25,000, and it's certainly not $1,000. Moreover, if you look at some of the national trends, and Oregon is not immune from those national trends, if you want to convert those numbers that I just gave to you in some sort of a different metric, people have saved on average for about 2 years of their retirement. On average, people spend about 17 years in retirement. Moreover, about half of the employees, private sector employees in the state of Oregon, do not have access to a retirement plan through their place of employment. The implication there is that they're either relying on Social Security or they're relying on other means for their retirement. The bottom line is this, from a public policy perspective, if people cannot save on their own, voluntarily for their own retirement, the cost to taxpayers could be staggering in terms of down the road reliance on social safety net services, which I think everybody in this room understands are very expensive services to provide. In terms of Oregon's future economic vitality, I don't want to make too much of the economic aspect of this, but it can't be understated either. Oregon is both an aging state and we're a small business state. In terms of aging, the population of people in our state over the age of 65 is expected to double in the next 20 years. And of course, as I've just mentioned, a lot of those folks are retiring with inadequate retirement savings, and far too many are actually going to retire directly into poverty. And according to the SBA, we are a small business state. By their definition, about 98% of the people employed in the state of Oregon are employed by small businesses. Our state's future, I'm sorry, that statistic is not wrong. I just gave you a bad statistic. 98% of the employers in the state of Oregon are small businesses. Our state's future economic vitality, therefore, is very dependent on this question of retirement security, and particularly as it relates to older adults. You passed in 2013 House Bill 3436. You convened what was called the Retirement Savings Task Force. You asked me to chair it. You asked a number of esteemed citizens to participate and serve on that task force. You gave us very specific direction. There were two basic thrusts of that direction. Number one, figure out why more people aren't preparing for retirement savings. And number two, find out why those who are engaged in a retirement savings program aren't saving adequately. And then number three, as an implied number three, make recommendations back to you as the legislative body. Another focus of context here, just traditionally, and I'm sure most of you here are very well aware of this, Social Security used to provide more of one's retirement savings than it does today. At the time Social Security was created, it was originally designed to carry people as a safety net between approximately the age of 62, when people reached the retirement age, to age 67, which was when actuarially on average you were expected to die. Mm-hmm. So the plan, Social Security, was basically to cover people through approximately 5 years. As I just said, we're outliving that pessimistic actuarial assumption, and now on average people are spending about 17 years in retirement. Pensions have changed as well, and there's been a great deal of discussion about pensions in the legislative body. You all understand that there's been a shift from the defined benefit programs, where employers provided long-term professional and pooled management of retirement resources, and at the time you reached your retirement age, your portion of that plan would be converted to an annuity, and that would carry you through your remaining years of retirement. But as defined benefits have disappeared and defined contributions have come to the fore, traditional 401k programs, there's been consequences, not only for Oregonians in terms of them having to support the information going into their plan, understanding what different investment options are available, choosing how much they wanted to participate and at what levels they wanted to participate. We've not only seen that continue, but we've also seen that there's been a significant reduction in retirement readiness as a result of some of those structural changes in the retirement market. The task force heard tremendous testimony from behavioral economists, from businesses both large and small, from nonprofit service providers on an array of issues related to retirement savings. And what we really learned was that despite the fact that there are a myriad of private sector products and plans on the market, there are no shortage of options available on the private sector market, there were still significant gaps in what was available to employees and where it was available to employees. In fact, small businesses are disproportionately less likely to offer retirement plans to their employees, despite the fact that 85% say they would like to. And the bottom line there from the testimony we heard is that both the cost to small businesses and the complexity of the plan offerings create some barriers to them participating and being able to offer those programs to their employees. There's also some issues with regard to the structure of employment. People tend to be moving more frequently from job to job. More people have part-time employment, and those also serve as potential barriers. I mentioned employer size. Gender, race, and ethnicity turned out to be a very hot topic for our task force. If you are a working age woman, a minority, or an employee of a small business, you are far less likely to have access to retirement saving tools that would ensure that you have an adequate retirement savings. And of course, income and age, as you can expect, also had implications for retirement security. I just want to mention one thing on the age. Oftentimes, people are a little surprised when they hear that this is not just about older adults. Certainly, that's the frame that most people think about when they're thinking about retirement security. This is very much an issue for younger Oregonians as well. It has been said before in this building, millennials have the worst saving rates of any generation at this point in their age, of any generation in modern American history. They have tremendous student debt. They have graduated, those who've gone on to college, into an economy that was not yet ready to hire them. And as a result, they have very poor savings rates. And it's causing a lot of consequences for our economy. You can just ask anybody in the housing market. But it's also having consequences with regard to their ability to save adequately for retirement. And the reality is, the sooner and the more you put into a retirement savings plan, the more likely you are to take advantage of the compound earnings that come later and provide you those adequate levels of retirement security. So it's really important for us not to forget that we also have to encourage younger people to start preparing adequately for their retirement. So, long story short, the overall recommendation of your retirement savings task force was that the state of Oregon develop and offer a voluntary retirement savings vehicle to all Oregonians who do not have access to a retirement vehicle through their place of employment. We further recommended that there are 9 key attributes that we recommend to the legislative body that we think are particularly important for a retirement savings vehicle of this nature. I don't think I'm going to go through all of these in any great detail. I just want to highlight a couple very briefly. This is all in the Retirement Savings Task Force report, and you can certainly read it, or you can ask us follow-up questions later. First of all, obviously, the key attribute of voluntary participation is front and center with what's called auto-enroll. Auto-enroll meaning that as you are employed, you are automatically enrolled in the retirement savings vehicle. It is voluntary insofar as you as the employee get to decide whether or not you want to participate. And if you do not want to participate, then you can opt out. The second attribute is what's called auto-escalation, meaning as your tenure improves or as your salary increases, you as the employee get to decide at what level you would like your contributions to increase from a low starting level to potentially higher percentages of your take-home pay as you're more able to actually afford to put more into your retirement savings plan. The plan should be portable as people go in and out of employment or from employer to employer. It should be pooled and professionally managed, meaning the assets are actually invested as much as possible as a pool to take advantage of higher rates of return through institutional due diligence and professional management, and to keep the costs as low as possible by not fragmenting the investment pool. To Representative Matthews' point, the program should be self-sustaining. That was a very clear directive from you. That's something we on the task force agree. It should be paid for out of the assets of the plan, meaning there is no ongoing financial liability either for the state and its taxpayers or for the employers themselves. In terms of program governance and management, we recommended creating a state board which is responsible for sponsoring and overseeing the program. We had also recommended that the legislature provide resources to continue to do research that is necessary for us to continue to conduct or for a board to continue to conduct, including market research. There needs to be much more done in terms of outreach to small business, and I'm continuing that effort on my own volition, but I believe that the board that you impanel should continue to do that as well. We should have an evaluation of tax credits and other incentives to not only encourage participation, but also potentially to offset any administrative or time costs that might be incurred, particularly by small employers, as this program unfolds. There is significant legal guidance, particularly around ERISA, that must be resolved. And we all agree that financial literacy programming is very important. It's not sufficient. That's what we heard from the experts who testified before the task force, but we all agreed that financial literacy programming continues to be very important, and it has been neglected for too long, and we'd like to see more of it, so we'd like to see that formalized by the legislature. We'd like to leave it to the discretion of the legislative body in terms of what structure you would actually like to create if you choose to create a state-sponsored retirement savings vehicle. And I particularly want to defer to the preference of the legislative sponsors, Tobias Reed and Lee Beyer. But I would be remiss if I stood here or sat here in front of the legislature and didn't give you my gut reaction and my preferred course of action. First and foremost, you should take a good hard look, would be my recommendation, at a program that is broadly accepted, broadly understood, and operates very well, which is your Oregon College Savings Plan, your 529 College Savings Plan. It has a public board, just as recommended by this task force, that in this case, is appointed. It's ratified by you and the legislative body. That board provides transparency and public accountability to the taxpayers of this state. But it also determines the attributes of the plan, which is then RFP'd, sent out to the private sector, where they operate it and manage it on an ongoing basis under the auspices and the accountability of that public board, which is accountable to you as the legislative body. That 529 model, I think, has worked very well. It's provided a good partnership between state government and the private sector, and it's created the kind of public transparency and accountability that I think the citizens of this state expect. I would also encourage you, and I believe that you will see a bill not unlike this coming your way, to take a good hard look at a voluntary IRA type structure with both auto enroll and payroll deductions. Some of you may have read in the press in the last couple of days that the state of Illinois has just passed such a structure, and it is going to, or is probably already sitting on the governor's desk at this point. We believe that structure, based on the testimony we've heard and the subsequent research that we've conducted in the Treasury, addresses the ERISA issues as fully as possible. And again, we think that legal issue is very important. But going forward, we want to continue to work with you with whatever structure you determine is in the best interest, and we want to be helpful to that effort in any way we can, and we are offering that help and assistance going forward here today. So thank you for your forbearance and your patience, and we'd certainly be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Okay, thank you. First of all, this is a very, very important aspect. My dad's always kind of sitting here, and I've been one of these rare people that has been saving since I was 12. And so, wow. And I came out of public sector retirement. Oh, yes. And so it was always one of those, do you really need this, or should you put the money away in savings? And so I put the money away in savings. But I had the avenues to do it, and a lot of people don't. I mean, a lot of us, gray hairs under here, remember when we used to have the payroll deduction of money going into savings every month. And if we got a raise, sometimes people chose to have that go into that. So we had a mechanism to go through and do it. I remember when I taught, well, I used to teach, believe it or not, personal finance as a sophomores, and then they had a semester as seniors, and so there was a lot of financial literacy coming out of the schools. So I'm very, very glad that this task force has come up with some very good recommendations. Other questions or comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the presentation. I absolutely love this concept. I think it's very exciting. Indeed, I think kind of the innovation that's happening in states around this issue, Minnesota, Illinois, Oregon, is kind of one of the more exciting things in this field since the advent of 529 programs in the late 90s. So recognizing that this hasn't quite calcified and there's a lot of things in motion, I'd like to ask, kind of get your gut and it might involve some speculation. Feel free to punt if you want. But one of the things about 529, and it seems like Oregon and many other states are kind of basing this approach on the 529, in order to make it portable, it's also open across state lines. For example, any Oregon citizen can, the Utah and Nevada 529s are some of the most popular because people like Vanguard, for example. Do you foresee something like that happening with this when it comes out? Do you think, for example, Oregon residents might choose to avail themselves of, say, the Illinois model and vice versa? Do you think that's how it's going to shake out when this is done?
So, Representative Barton, through Chair Doherty and members of the committee, the answer is unequivocally, I have no bloody idea. I don't know. But I will give you the latest update that I can give you. I literally just got back from the National Association of State Treasurers meeting in New York, where I sat on a panel with people who really are experts on this subject. And this question was raised in many different capacities, and nobody knows the answer. But the bottom line is that it will require the federal government's action in order to break down those state-by-state mm-hmm. barriers, just as with the changes, mm-hmm. the 529 IRS tax code changes, they brought down the barriers state by state. We're not there yet, and the program that we're envisioning, therefore, is solely for the state of Oregon, but it does create some obvious employment issues, for example, multi-state employers. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There are issues that will have to be addressed at the federal level, and it's my personal belief that the states, since they are taking the lead on this, are driving the federal government towards resolving these issues and taking action. And that's pretty clear just from the comments that are coming out of the DOL at the federal level and elsewhere. The states are definitely leading on this area, and we're pushing Congress.
Any other comments, questions? Representative Fagan.
Which mic was that one? Okay, this one's mine. Okay, great. Well, thank you, Chair Doherty, and I, like Representative Barton, am very excited about this concept. I recall from when we discussed it in the last session, at least an impression, whether it was overblown or not, I don't know, that there were significant ERISA issues. And you mentioned that there's some legal analysis out there, which leads me to believe none of these state programs have actually been court challenged yet. There's not actually a court speaking on the ERISA issues of these. There's legal analysis. And I, for one, I don't know if other members of the committee would share that, would be very interested, just because in my private life, I actually do employment law and am more familiar, I think, than anybody wants to be with ERISA, and would love to see kind of the best legal analysis that you think is out there. But do correct me if I'm wrong, that there's no actual courts that have weighed in. It's just legal analysis so far.
Representative Fagan, through Chair Doherty and members of the committee, you are correct. There has not yet been a legal challenge. If you can give me just 2 more minutes, I want to get into this question of ERISA just a little bit deeper, because I have some late-breaking information here. If you use the IRA structure, IRAs are specifically exempted from ERISA. And I want to be clear, there's many good things about ERISA. ERISA was designed to protect people who are saving for retirement. And so Illinois and other states, Maryland, Massachusetts, their plans and our plan should mirror those aspects or parallel those aspects of ERISA designed to protect the interest of people who are saving for retirement. That said, ERISA also implies liability potentially for the state and potentially for employers, both in terms of documentation and disclosure requirements, administrative costs as a result, and also what are called cause of action opportunities, meaning it exposes you to legal liability. So on balance, we think it's better as a task force, and you as a legislature actually directed us in our studies to make sure that the state was not exposed and employers were not exposed to liability under ERISA. That's why we think the IRA type structure is superior, because it's specifically exempted from ERISA. There are 2 main questions, though, that are outstanding, and we probably won't have the answer to them without the Department of Labor commenting or without a court action, as you say. The first is, under ERISA, an IRA is only exempt if it meets certain criteria. One of the criteria is that it must be completely voluntary for employees. So the question is, if you auto-enroll me and I have the ability to opt out, does that meet the legal definition of completely voluntary? Completely voluntary, by the way, is not defined. You will not find a definition anywhere, so don't bother. I've tried through multiple sources. The second part of it is that the employer cannot be, what's the word they use? It's not advocating. Endorsing. Employers cannot endorse the program. That's also an important legal question. They already have FICA withholdings, they already pay sales tax, and those have not been determined to be endorsements of either FICA or paying sales taxes. So there are those in the legal community who believe this meets. The most recent information I have is a report released last week from the Georgetown University Center for Retirement on Retirement Initiatives. The author of the report was David Morse from K&L Gates, which is a law firm I'm sure many of you are familiar with. And the conclusion that they reached was a state would need to design an IRA program to meet the DOL exception for IRAs being accepted from ERISA. This could be met if a state would set the IRA terms, select vendors and permissible investments, and prepare and distribute the marketing employee communication materials. The employer role would need to be limited to making the state IRA available to its workers, distributing materials and election forms, answering basic questions, and withholding and transmitting employee contributions. So that is one legal interpretation. But as I said right up front, I don't think we have final answers on any of this, and we as a state should be very particular and very specific about doing our own research.
Okay, thank you. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Treasurer Wheeler, thank you so much for your leadership and efforts in making retirement savings plans available to the broad Oregon public. Unlike the college savings plan, which welcomes all comers, your recommendations seem to limit retirement savings to individuals who don't have retirement savings at work. Can you explain the reasoning behind that?
Yes. The research that we heard and the testimony we received as a task force made it clear that the best place for people to have access to a retirement savings vehicle is through their place of employment. People are more reluctant to go to a storefront on their own. They're more reluctant to wade through the myriad of options. If there is easy access at their place of employment, that's just a convenience node that makes it easier for people to retire, to be engaged in a retirement savings vehicle. And that's why, even though there are so many good plans available out there and so many employers who offer them, still half of the people who work in the private sector don't have access to one through their place of employment. So we believe the structure that we're providing with the attributes we've identified reduce a number of the barriers and the costs and the inhibitions to people participating in a retirement plan, and things like auto-enroll and auto-escalate help increase the savings rates for those who are participating once they are participating in a plan.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Kinnemer.
Yeah, thank you. Again, I'd say thank you for your leadership on this, and I think this is a gigantic issue, particularly because life expectancy is increasing dramatically. And I guess a couple of comments. I'm lucky in that I had a dad who, somewhat like the chair's dad, said I ought to save. Unfortunately, we're extraordinarily poor, and it was a very slow start, but eventually we caught up with the idea. I guess a couple of thoughts as I look at yours. Something else that I wonder if you don't want to add to your list of criteria is some estimation of what kind of money people are going to need. It's very interesting to me. When I started employment 55 years ago, 95 cents an hour was the minimum wage. I could never imagine that I would need the amount of money that I need now in my wildest dreams. I mean, I would have been filthy rich at that point in time, were I to have the amount of money that one needs to retire at this point. So I think people need to think of that. A couple of other things that are related to that is I remember in the 60s and 70s, we were also taught that we needed to have a retirement income of approximately two-thirds of our salary. The evidence is that most all of us retirees now spend substantially more in retirement, and we do not simply sit and walk down the street three blocks for exercise and read our newspaper and wait for the Grim Reaper. And part of that's also tied into the other piece is that most of us are going to, as you said, 17 years, and I think that number's increasing dramatically. So it's a pretty long-term proposition. And I just think we may need to realize this needs to be a lot more aggressive than perhaps we're thinking.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Chair Daugherty. I really realize two things in this discussion. One is I want to be Representative Kinnemer when I grow up. And two, I'd like
<Don't>
to spend just a couple minutes explaining the voluntary thing.
A very few couple minutes.
Well, maybe a couple seconds then.
No.
You had, in your presentation I read prior to the meeting, you have the term voluntary, but you described it somewhat differently in your presentation. So maybe you could explain a little bit of what that means.
So under ERISA, this let's see if I can get this right, because I want to be accurate for Representative Free. The state cannot compel participation in an ERISA plan. That's a fundamental aspect of ERISA. So with that as sort of the headline over everything else I'm saying, it's important that the plan be voluntary for participants. We do not want to force people into a state-sponsored retirement plan. And that is probably as much a philosophical position of the task force you impaneled, as well as an important aspect of maintaining the integrity to the requirement you put on us that the plan cannot expose the state to liability under ERISA. And therefore, we think a voluntary plan is the right way to go. So if I'm an employee, Kristen hires me, she hands me a piece of paper that says, congratulations, you are auto-enrolled in Plan X. If you do not wish to participate in Plan X, sign here, and you're out. So it's an opt-out plan. Now, some people might ask, why is it opt-out versus opt-in? Opt-out plans have much higher participation, and follow-up surveys with employees who've participated in auto-enroll plans are very happy about them, because a lot of them admit after the fact that they might not have started saving for retirement but for that attribute. So we see it as an important attribute. Some of you may have read an Oregonian editorial some many number of months ago raising the question, is opt-out really voluntary? And I think that's a philosophical conversation. I think it does imply a responsibility to be very clear with employees that they have the right to opt out. There can't be any obfuscation of that fact. Does that answer your question, Representative?
So the voluntary portion's for the employee, not
correct.
The employer.
Correct.
It's mandated for all employers.
Right. And we
okay,
we
that's the part I was
yeah,
asking.
We as a task force have not set any criteria with regard to that aspect. State of California, I think, made it mandatory for any employer over 25 employees that does not have a plan. I think Illinois did something different, but I'm not sure exactly what it was.
It's kind of a follow-up to Representative Freeman. So it's one of these things that I opt in, and my employer just has the avenue that I can send $20 a month to U.S. Bank or something. Is that what the employer's responsibility
is? In basic
is?
Terms, yes. It would be a payroll deduction.
Mm-hmm. Okay, option.
So it'd
okay.
be it would be a payroll checkoff.
Right. Okay, anything else? Okay, thank you very much. We look forward to
thank you.
Hearing more about this in 2015.
Thank you, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. Thank you for your time.
Okay. Okay, the next person we have on the agenda is Representative Doherty. And actually, I'm going to give an update on the OLCC task force. The joint task force on the OLCC was created by President Courtney, and I'm speaking from up here, by the way. I'm Representative Doherty, Margaret Doherty, representing House District 35, Tigard and Southwest Portland. But anyway, this task force was put together by Senator Courtney and Speaker Kotek last July, shortly after the backers of an initiative to allow the sale of distilled spirits in grocery stores dropped their effort. The membership, there were co-chairs, myself and Senator Beyer. The senators, the representative was Senator Girard and Senator Johnson. Our representatives were Representative Hoyle and Representative Andy Olson. And so far, the task force has met four times. Three of the meetings were devoted to hearing from the OLCC staff themselves and were fully briefed on the OLCC operations. And what this included was the retail services, how products are selected, accommodating special orders and orders for less than a full case. So if you're a liquor agent in King City, you don't want to buy an entire case of Bailey's Irish Cream, you only want four, they have the opportunity of go through and have partial cases and this kind of thing to go through and fill your orders. They also have the opportunity and the ability, if you have somebody that wants to order a $4,000 bottle of scotch or a $12,000 bottle of scotch, that they have the ability to go through and get that for you and have it delivered to your local liquor store.
And these are the presents you're giving us.
Yes.
Yeah.
I didn't want to. Yeah. You can read right through me, don't you, Representative Kinnerman?
Sorry about that. I just couldn't use it.
And there are. I mean, we saw one that was, I think, more than 12,000.
Seriously?
Yes. Oh, yes. So, anyway, when we also had presentations on how projected demands for liquor impacts the revenue in the state of Oregon, and quite high revenue generator for Oregon are the distilled spirits. The number and the location of liquor stores, and it's everything from a huge liquor store on Jansen Beach, which happens to get a lot of Washington retailers, to one that a place I don't think anyone's ever heard of, and I can't remember what it was, but very, very small, and those are usually liquor stores in grocery stores. It was interesting, the number and location of liquor stores, the population served by the areas, and where new liquor stores may be opened. And they went through and had, for example, the state of Kentucky has one liquor store for every 1,700, I believe, Kentuckians, and where we may have one for every 15,000. So it was interesting to go state by state as to what they were doing. We can get all this information to you. Yeah, a lot of liquor stores, a lot of liquor agents in Kentucky. The type of liquor stores as either what we call exclusive, where only liquor is sold, or non-exclusive, where liquor is sold along with other goods, whether it be mixers, whether it be glasses, whether salts, that kind of thing. The compensation of the store agents, we had a presentation on that. A comparison of state and national data, and that was interesting, as I say, with the number of stores, the number of services, the breakdowns of where they are in different states. The capacity of the warehouse to meet demands and timely orders, we spent quite a bit of time on this. We went to the OLCC warehouse in Milwaukee and toured the facility and learned that 2.95 million cases were shipped this fiscal year, and the warehouse does this with 47.5 FTE and uses a single conveyor belt to get the liquor from the huge warehouse to the trucks that deliver it. And so it was something that they are looking at very, very carefully, especially the updating of the OLCC facility. We went over options that we have to create more capacity in the warehouses, and the OLCC has been looking very carefully at this. Option A, for example, is a capital expenditure, which I believe they're going to be asking for this session, of $5.2 million to an additional conveyor system with software to allow cases to be sorted so orders can go out on five loading docks as opposed to the one that's currently being used. Or option B was to add 14 FTE to a swing shift and widen the shipping window by about 2 hours. So those were the two options they were looking at. The fourth meeting was devoted to hearing directly from the craft beverage industry. This included beer, wine, distilled spirits, and ciders. It was a great historical look at an industry that has really taken off. They heard proposals from some legislation, some administrative rule, to help the craft industry. And we also heard from the tourism and hospitality industries as to how important these craft beverage industry are to the state of Oregon. At the last meeting, the members heard from OLCC staff about the passage of Ballot Measure 91 to legalize marijuana sales. And the agency will be responsible for taxing, licensing, and regulating marijuana, retail marijuana. Our final meeting is tomorrow at 12:30 in Hearing Room E to receive public testimony regarding liquor sales. It's still very premature to deal with the marijuana issue, but they will be dealing with the liquor sales. And so that's a preview of the summary of what we went over. Do you have any questions or whatever? If you haven't been out to OLCC, I'm sure they're glad to give you a tour of their facility in Milwaukee, because it is amazing what they do with very antiquated delivery systems. The one conveyor belt is, I was appalled. So anyway, that's it. Okay, thank you very much. Okay, the next thing we have up on our agenda is a discussion of legislative concepts related to business and labor. And what we did is we sent out an invitation to all stakeholder groups, whether they be business, labor, to see if they wanted to have a few minutes to go through and give us a little in-service as to what some their priorities are. And so the people that we heard back from was Boley, NFIB, and AOI. So if Paloma and Jan and Betsy would like to come up, if you still want to, we can talk about some of the concepts that you're looking at for this legislative session, kind of a little preview. And, in fact, before we start, was there anybody else that wanted to give a preview? These were the three that we heard from. Okay, thank you very much. You can identify yourself for the record.
Good morning. For the record, I'm Paloma Sparks with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. The Bureau of Labor and Industries enforces anti-discrimination laws in workplaces, housing, and public accommodations, and enforces wage and hour laws, educates employers to help them avoid unnecessary worker complaints, and works with labor, business, and other organizations to develop a highly skilled, competitive workforce in Oregon. And we will be pursuing bills this session or supporting bills this session that sort of address all of those. We will be working on a bill to expand career and technical education. There's a number of concepts out there, but one we will be focused on is expanding the CTE Revitalization Grant Fund. The governor has discussed that in his budget proposal, but we think that we need to go big. At this point, we have managed to return CTE classes to 200 schools. We can do more. We need to restore the pipeline of workers that will fill the jobs of the future. We've been told that the average age of a lineman for PGE is 57. We have a problem. And so that is one of our primary goals this session, is to expand CTE. We'll also be working on a number of tools to expand enforcement capacity within the agency for wage and hour issues. Key among them will be an effort to give the commissioner cease and desist authority. Under our civil rights statutes, we have that authority. We don't have it in wage and hour. And what that is that the commissioner will be able to issue a cease and desist assist order when he is doing an investigation and he has probable cause to believe that the violation occurred. And then we are also looking at requiring employers to post bonds if they fail to maintain a payday or fail to pay regularly. We do this existing. It's one of the requirements under the prevailing wage laws. And what you would do is require an employer to post a bond that wages could be paid out of. Finally, we are also pursuing an effort to give the commissioner the authority to issue garnishment orders. We have 30 million in unsatisfied judgments in wage and hour laws alone. So we think that there are some employers, most employers do great work and would never avoid having to pay their employees. There are some that will start moving assets, start changing business names. So this is an enforcement tool that we're pursuing. Finally, early this year, a report on equal pay was published by the Oregon Council on Civil Rights, which is a partnership with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. And in that study, it was revealed that in Oregon, women still make 79 cents to the dollar for what men earn. And a lot of this is due to what is phrased as the mother's penalty. Working mothers over time face a significant loss in wages and retirement funds because of the difficulty of being in the workplace and caring for children. So we are looking at a number of legislative proposals that were identified in that report. One is expanding our existing fair pay laws. There are fair pay laws on the books in the wage and hour statutes, but they're rarely utilized. We want to mirror those existing laws into the civil rights laws, so make it clear that this is a civil rights issue. And then there's been a lot of talk about employees being able to disclose information about what they earn and whether or not employers can retaliate against them. So we will be looking at a bill to protect employees from retaliation if they share their wage data with one another. This does not mean that your HR person would be releasing all of your pay data. It means among employees sharing information. Next, we are looking at a bill to protect employees who request flexible or predictable schedules. This is a problem if you're a working mother. You really need to know what your schedule is going to be in the next week to know that you are going to have childcare or to make new arrangements if your schedule is going to change. And this is to make sure that people are protected and are not retaliated against. You don't want to ask for a predictable schedule and then all of a sudden you just don't end up on the schedule anymore. Finally, we have a proposal to provide unpaid leave for parents to be able to attend children's school activities, school conferences, school plays. If your kids get sick and you need to go and pick them up early, most employers would, of course, be very understanding about that. There are some that think that means that you are not dedicated to your job because you take time off to deal with your children's lives at school. And then finally, we are working with a large coalition focused on raising the minimum wage. This is a key element of the equal pay report. 62% of minimum wage earners are women. The median minimum wage earner is a woman in her 30s raising a family. These are no longer starter jobs. So we believe that no one should work full-time and be living below the poverty level. And we think that we should raise the minimum wage and take it seriously. Happy to answer any questions you might have.
Okay, we'll just wait till the panel's finished and we'll ask questions. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Betsy Earls, representing Associated Oregon Industries. And I will be working with all of you and the rest of the legislature this session on labor and employment issues. And most days, I'm actually looking forward to that. So we have just a couple priorities, and I'll cover them quickly. But probably our most important one has to do with workers' compensation. Last time that you worked on a fix for workers' compensation that had to do with addressing court decisions, you basically had one case, and that was the Cortez decision. This session, we are looking at a few decisions that have happened since then that we need to address to maintain what we see as the integrity of the Mahonia Hall agreements and the strength of the workers' compensation system benefits and reasonable premiums. So the cases mainly have to do with benefits, how benefits are paid when there's an undiagnosed pre-existing condition or a combined condition. And I'll just take them in order. There are two main cases that I wanted to talk with you about. The first one is the Schleiss decision. And I think the best way to look at it is, say somebody has a bad back, they had a ski injury, they hurt themselves, but they never went to the doctor because it seemed like it was going away on its own. They try now not to bend over quite as far because it still hurts sometimes, so there is an impairment, but it's not something that they really want to perhaps admit that they had a ski accident and went to the doctor. But then they end up straining their back at work, and that aggravates the older ski injury, and that's when they end up going to the doctor and getting a diagnosis. So the ski injury is undiagnosed pre-existing condition, and then we have this other thing that makes it feel much worse, and so finally we go to the doctor, which I think is something we can all identify with. So prior to Schleiss, which came down about a year ago from the Supreme Court, a doctor would diagnose the work injury and determine the percentage of the total impairment that was due to what happened at work as opposed to perhaps on the ski slopes. And that impairment would be compensated or not, depending on what the insurer accepted. But under SLICE, the whole impairment, including the pre-existing condition, and again, the key is that it wasn't diagnosed before, but just that it was a pre-existing condition, is potentially compensable since it was aggravated by a work injury. So our solution is not to make a dramatic change in the workers' compensation law, but make it clearer that benefits are statutorily tied only to an accepted condition. So that is the first piece that we're looking at. The second piece is, say we have the same injury, the same ski accident, and the name of the case is, it's the Royce Brown decision, commonly referred to as Brown. But we have treatment that is compensable for the combined condition, which is, you know, the ski injury that has been aggravated by the work condition and the work condition, as long as the work injury remains the major contributing cause of that impairment, of that injury, the thing that hurts, basically. But now under Brown, the insurer can be required to continue paying for treatment for the injury even after, or the potential disability, even after the work injury is no longer the major contributing cause. So the work injury has been successfully treated. There's still, you know, residual pain from the ski accident, and the insurer continues to have to pay for that. And in the past, that payment would have stopped, payment for treatment would have stopped at the time that the injury was no longer the major, the work injury was no longer the major contributing cause. So we'll be bringing legislation to you to bring both of those back into alignment with what we see as the Mahonia-Hall agreements. We haven't done that yet simply because MLAC hasn't thoroughly vetted this or any other work compensation bills at this point, but we'll be looking at that this session. We have two other priorities, and I think one that is important to mention is that we fully support Boley's CTE proposal. I would add to that, though, that most of what we see in the governor's budget has CTE funding going into Oregon Department of Education, which means CTE for K-12. And we would also like to see CTE programs and CTE funding for community college education. So that's something that we'll be working on this session. I know the governor's budget has a way that they see that happening already, but we'd like to make it a little bit clearer. So we'll be pushing that. And finally, we will be working with you on the idea of a statewide preemption of all local employment-related mandates in an effort to stabilize the employment situation for multi-location employers.
Okay.
So that's what we got.
Thank you very much. Jan?
Good morning. My name is Jan Meekums. I'm the state director for NFIB, National Federation of Independent Business. We have employers that are larger, 300 employees, but our average employer has less than 10 employees. And we have about 7,200 members in the state of Oregon. So we truly represent small employers. Our mission is to protect and promote the right of our members to own, operate, and grow their businesses. So we will be busy working in that direction over the legislative session. NFIB was a member of the Paid Sick Leave Task Force, and I agree with what Senator Steyer Hayward had to say, that it was inclusive, and they definitely tried to engage everyone and seek everyone's input into the process. So we will be very engaged with that issue. Another task force that NFIB was participated in, not on the task force, but certainly was engaged with Treasurer Wheeler, was the retirement plan, because that is definitely focused and directed directly at our members. It is of great concern to our members, and there's a lot to voice what Representative Matthews had to say coming at small business in this session regarding what Boley issues that Boley just mentioned. Minimum wage, paid sick leave, all of these are very important to our members. So unfortunately, we'll be involved more maybe on a defensive issue than offensive. We are working with some legislators in the area of regulations, seeing what we can do to reduce some of the more onerous regulations and also simplify paperwork and administrative issues. And the preemption bill that, or the preemption issue that was just mentioned by AOI is also an important issue for our small employers to create some employment stability within the state. So that's mainly what we are doing at this point of the session. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions for the panelists? Representative Witt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Paloma, I took note of your mention of an increase in the minimum wage, and some of us have been hearing a great deal about proposed increases, some of the proposals in the neighborhood of a 60% increase over current minimum wage levels. And while I personally would like to see a wage floor that would be as high as Representative Kenemer's income, as a former economist, I know that's probably not realistic. And you mentioned that no one should have to work full-time for poverty-level wages. Has the Bureau taken a look at what wage rate would be necessary to lift someone out of that poverty level? Because my rough calculation, poverty level for a family of three, I think, is around a little over $11.50 an hour.
Chair Doherty, Representative Witt, yes, we have looked at what that number is. Mm-hmm. We believe that for 2016, that would be a little bit above, for a family of four, would be a little bit above $12 an hour.
Uh-huh.
And we believe that given who the minimum wage earners are these days, that makes sense for families and for the state to move forward.
Thank you very much. That's very helpful.
Okay, thank you very much. Any other questions, comments? Okay, thank you. And I know we'll be seeing a lot more of all of you in the upcoming session. Thank you very
much. Thank you.
Okay. Do any of the members have any concepts that they would like to divulge of their own personal concepts? Going once? Not you. Going twice?
Go ahead, Mr. Matthews.
Yeah. Yes, Representative Matthews has none, I don't think.
Oh, I have personal concepts.
You do have, I know.
I'll carry them all for you, buddy.
Okay, so with that, I close the informational meeting and open up a work session on introduction of committee legislation. We have to have committee legislation. We're now in a work session. Okay. And so on OLIS and information, there are a couple of bills. And those of you that have not gone through this before, people come to us and say, can you just have this as a committee bill? And so the one thing about a committee bill that are introduced, you do not have to. This does not mean you are supporting the bill. Does not mean that you're supporting the concept. Just means what we're doing is we're moving the concept forward into the process to be assigned to the speaker and that kind of thing. It does not give you any obligation to vote for it or anything else when you get down on the floor. So that's what it is. So Jan, if you could go through, we've got five concepts, I believe.
Right.
And they are on OLIS except for the fifth one. So Jan, if you could go through and summarize those.
Chair Doherty. Yes, even the fifth one was just added this morning. But the first two, LC-1156 and LC-1158, is at the request of Ask Me Council 75. LC-1156 is relating to the transfers of public employees between public employers. LC-1158 is relating to public employee collective bargaining. LC-1492 was at the request of the Oregon Correction Employees Association, and it's relating to issues subjective to collective bargaining for the Department of Corrections employees. LC-1579 is relating to timely payment of wages, and the one that just came in, you have, I think, a hard copy before you because it was so new this morning. Mm-hmm. It's LC-2750. It's at the request of the Oregon Self-Insurers Association, and it is relating to civil penalties imposed for claims processing violations of workers' compensation claims.
Okay, so as I said, I want to emphasize that voting voting to introduce committee bills does not necessarily indicate support of the concept, but agreement to allow the concept to be discussed as a legislative measure in 2015. With this, Representative Barton.
Madam Chair, I move that the following five legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills. LC 1156, dated October 24th, 2014. LC 1158, dated November 14th, 2014. LC 1492, dated October 6th, 2014. LC 1579, dated November 19th, 2014. And LC 2750, dated November 6th, 2014. Okay. I move that those be introduced as committee bills.
Okay, thank you. Chair Barton moves that LC 1156, dated October 24th, 2014, LC 1158, dated November 14th, 2014, LC 1492, dated October 6th, 2014, LC 1579, dated November 19th, 2014, and LC 2750, dated November 6, 2014, be introduced as committee bills. Is there any discussion? Representative Witt?
Madam Chair, some of these bills seem to be fairly complex, and I was wondering if we could have a cursory review of some of them might be trying to accomplish in a very limited fashion.
I don't know. Jan?
I can give a quick summary, unless there's some of the requesters that are here, and I don't see them.
Jan can give you a cursory. It's not going to be in depth.
No. Okay.
Just starting
conceptually,
at the top.
What are we trying to achieve?
Okay, thank you.
The first one, 1156, it includes Oregon nonprofit corporations as the definition of a public employer for the purpose of certain public employee transfers. Right now, a public employer that takes on the duty of an employer that the duties are being done by a public agency employee. A school district can take on those duties, an ESD can take on those duties, a local government. The employee can transfer over. It would now add a nonprofit Oregon corporation.
That's very helpful.
Okay. LC 1158, it's modifying the definition of a public employee for the purpose of collective bargaining, and it specifies that for those public sector supervisory employees, the only appropriate bargaining unit is the one that consists only of supervisory employees. So you can't be mixing in managerial and confidential employees. LC 1492 is going to include the Department of Correction employees, those who have direct contact with inmates, only those. They will be in the category of employees for which on-the-job safety issues are employment relations that are going to be subject to collective bargaining. So right now there are certain employees, emergency workers, police, fire, that employment relations dealing with safety are negotiated. And so now it will be certain employees of the Department of Corrections, those who have direct contact with inmates. LC 1579, it proposes to allow BOLI to impose a civil penalty against employers who fail to pay wages on a regular payday. It's similar to what Paloma was talking about with requiring an employer to post a bond when they find an employer is not paying timely or keeping a regular payday. This allows BOLI to impose a penalty. And then the last one is the one that just came in today, and it is from self-insurers, and they want to be able to allow the Department of Consumer and Business Services to impose a civil penalty when there is a violation for processing workers' comp claims by a service company. Right now they can impose a penalty on an employer, but not on a service company. That's the brief.
That's very helpful. Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that.
Okay, any other discussion? Okay, is there any objection? Representative Widener?
I actually don't think I would support one of those bills, so
Well, we're not expecting anybody on this committee to support any.
So I don't think they should be going through as committee bills.
Yes, your vote will be recognized in the record. Okay. Anything else? Okay. If not, the measures are introduced as committee bills. Any other? I think that's it. Close the work session. And anything else for the good of the order? As I say, just on a personal note, Representative Thompson, Representative Matthews, Representative Freeman, we will miss you. Representative Thatcher will have to go all the way across the other side of the building to see you. But you have represented your constituents well and the people in the state of Oregon, and we thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, with that, meeting's closed. Thank you. Thank you. Meeting's closed.